trashy novels can be bad if we have a vision of what great literature is. But I thought it might be kind of fun to talk about, can great books be bad? So during the last session, we talked about some of the issues, how the great books got to be the great books, and a little bit of the history, canonical history, about what's, when we talk about canonical, we talk about what is in the literary canon, meaning what is accepted, all with supposedly the experts in colleges and universities and such, where they say that these are the books you need to read. But anyway, even these great books are not without their problems, and probably, so I thought it might be fun to talk about that, how we value literature and why we value what we do. So critics come and go, folks, you know, but great books last. So I think it's really important that we understand why we value what we value. So with that in mind, I want to tell you a story, and it's a true story, about what happened with one of my profs. I went to Chicago, the University of Chicago, and I had a teacher there whose name was Wayne Booth, and if you're interested in literature, if you look his name up, you'll see that he wrote a lot of really good books, The Rhetoric of Fiction, The Rhetoric of Irony, and those are like Bibles for English majors. And he also wrote a book called The Company We Keep, and that has to do with the ethics in fiction. All right, so right away we're getting into really dangerous waters, because we're talking about, are we going to take a look at art and look at it in terms of whether there are ethical values? And you could take a look at some of the paintings right in this room, and I'm pretty sure most of us would agree that we look at them aesthetically because of line or technique or whatever else, but we don't necessarily, you know, we always get into trouble if we start taking a look at art and we make moral or ethical judgments on them. And most college professors can get really snarky if somebody tries to censor what they're saying. And you know, I know I was thinking of teaching the Satanic Verses next year in this bad books class, and at Augustana College, we now have students on committees who help decide, you know, they have an input into what professors are teaching when it goes through the committees. But anyway, one of the students there said, well, you know, I could never go to that class, because he was a Muslim, and he said, I can't stand this book, and I couldn't go to that class. Well, right away, the faculty said, oh no, she can teach what she wants, she can teach controversy, but you don't have to go to that class. But I mean, right away, the idea that you would censor somebody is at least in the faculty's mind, problematic. So anyway, here's the story. This really did happen to Mr. Booth, and that's why he wrote The Ethics of Fiction. For years, in the core at the University of Chicago, for the undergrads, they had been happily teaching Huck Finn, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. So one year, while they were teaching it, one of the colleagues who was in the art department at the University of Chicago, his name was Paul Moses, and he was a black guy, he said, I can't stand teaching this. And I have a quote, at least, in The Ethics of Fiction, Mr. Booth kind of gave us a parody of what he could remember that Paul Moses said. And this is what Paul Moses said. It's hard for me to say this, but I have to say it anyway. I simply can't read Huckleberry Finn again. The way Mark Twain portrays Jim is so offensive to me that I get angry in class, and I can't get all those liberal white kids to understand why I get so angry. What's more, I don't think it's right to subject students, black or white, to the many distorted views of race on which that book is based. No, it's not the word nigger I'm not objecting to, it's the whole range of assumptions about slavery and its consequences, and about how whites should deal with liberated slaves, and how liberated slaves should behave or will behave toward whites, good ones and bad ones. That book is just bad education, and the fact that it's so cleverly written makes it even more troublesome to me. So anyway, that's his argument. Well, Mr. Booth, who, if you know him, he just died recently, but he's a very compassionate, kind heart. He's a great man, but he's never ever lost the common touch. And only a man like that would consider, at first, his first gut reaction, he's honest enough to admit it, oh, this guy really had a bad education if he doesn't know how great Huck Finn is. You know, it's too bad Paul Moses doesn't know anything better than that. And he kind of lamented that, but then he got to thinking about what Paul Moses said and why he said what he did. And then Mr. Booth got to think about, well, we all make choices, whether or not we make choices, ethical choices in fiction. So I'm going to let you folks decide this for yourselves. Because, you know, I can only give you the tools. I can't just indoctrinate you. I can tell you my opinion. But nevertheless, he wound up dedicating the ethics of fiction to Paul Moses. And so he wrote quite a book. I would recommend you read it if you're interested in this topic. But anyway, he wrote, and basically the argument he tries to make is we need to consider why Paul Moses or people like that would make judgments. And if you read the book carefully, you'll see that we do make judgments when we read. We all do, and their great books matter to us because they speak to us personally. And since they speak to us personally, we're bound to make judgments on how we feel about this. So anyway, I've got Huck here, and I also have Lolita here, and I want to read a little bit of that later on. But I want to show you a little bit about how this works and a little bit about the controversy in Huck. So I'll read the very first paragraph to you of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, and when I read it to you, listen and tell me what you're hearing, what you hear over and over, okay? You don't know about me without you've read a book by the name of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. But that ain't no matter. That book was made by Mr. Mark Twain, and he told the truth mainly. There were some things which he stretched, but mainly he told the truth. Well, that's nothing. I never ever seen anybody but lied one time or another about whether, you know, Musa was Aunt Polly or the widow or maybe Mary. Aunt Polly, Tom's Aunt Polly, she is, and Mary, and the widow Douglas, is all told about in that book, which is mostly a true book, with some stretchers, as I said before. So, what did you hear over and over? Tell me your name.
Yeah.
No, I'm asking the little guy.
Katie.
Katie, what did you hear over and over and over? What did he keep on saying, do you think?
He kept on saying that he told the truth, but...
Yeah, she's talking about whether he told the truth. Okay. Who's telling this story?
I don't know.
Yeah, who's telling the story?
The character in the story.
Who's the character? Huck. John.
Thomas
the story. No, this is...
Huck.
Huck's the one who's telling the story. All right, so we got that straight. Huck told the story. Who's the writer of the story?
Mark Twain.
Mark Twain. Who's Mark Twain?
Sam
Clemens. All right, so now let me get this straight. Huckleberry Finn is telling the story. Clemens wrote it, and what is Huck, Katie? Huckleberry Finn is talking about somebody telling the truth. The big gold star of the day is, who's he talking about who's telling the truth?
The author.
I'll read it again.
No, the author.
Well, yeah. So we have a character here in fiction who's talking about whether or not the author is telling the truth. And now think about it. Have you ever read a book like this before in your life? I mean,
that's,
you know,
why we like it.
There's something really weird about this.
We just want to read it.
Yeah, we all want to read it. So, for starters, we kind of have this slippage where there's one person who wrote the story and somebody else is telling the story. And not only, I mean, that happens a lot in fiction, but not only does that happen, but now we've got this character who turns out to be rather disreputable, who's commenting on whether the author is telling the truth or not. So there's something really weird going on in this book. All right. So, one of the things that is happening is Huck is telling a story. And but Twain's the author, and Huck is commenting on how Twain's telling the story, whether he told the truth. Okay. So, the point I'm trying to make here is that we have kind of this slippage of what's happening. We have the literal storyteller, and then we have the kind of the metaphoric storyteller, or somebody else. And what's starting to happen, Twain is laying the groundwork for irony. All right, so you hear one thing, literally, but you know, you get the sense right away that something else is going on. It's kind of like, sadly, my students can relate to this immediately. I say, look at the billboard, not so far away from Augustana College. If you want to drink and drive, Illinois police will show you the bars. So what is, you know, what does this mean? Yeah, they all laugh right away. But anyway, you get the meaning, Illinois police will show you the bars, but it may not quite be the bars that they would have in mind, right? And so they know it, and they see this billboard, and they laugh, and, you know, it scares them a little bit. But anyway, that's how irony works. So you hear something literally, but there's usually another meaning, and a lot of times it's funny. And a really great author can make this work, you know, in just the most artful way. So we have that kind of, from the get-go, that's going on. All right, so he comments on people telling the truth. And then Huck also, on a scale of 1 to 10, I'm assuming most of you people know something about Huck, even if you haven't read him yet. But on a scale of 1 to 10, if I were to ask you, is Huck very smart? I mean, being really stupid is number 1, and really smart would be number 10. I mean, where would we rate Huck? Where would you put him on a scale?
Probably 10.
You'd put him on a 10. Anybody else?
8 or 9.
8 or 9.
7 or 8.
8.
I was going to say 8.
8.
Depends on what you're measuring in terms of.
No, smartness. You just have to pick a number.
Well, I would say in terms of survival skills, he's close to 10.
I have never, in all the years I've been teaching, ever had a class like this. They all say 2 or 3, and I say, oh, you're all so dumb.
He's not educated, but he's smart.
Wait, I mean, he figured it out right away. You know, they think, my students, they think he doesn't speak well, he doesn't have proper grammar, so he's got to really be stupid. You have to disabuse these people with so many things. John, I mean, watch out. You know, go to school and be smarter than him. But anyway, maybe you won't want to come to Augustana College when you find out how bad they all are, huh? But anyway, So Huck is dumb like a fox, you know. I would give him at least a 10, maybe 1,000. But anyway, so this novel is filled with these kinds of examples where Huck just doesn't get it. But we, as the readers, do. We think maybe he's dumb on a bag of rocks. But nevertheless, he doesn't get it, and what he doesn't get are community values. And the reason he doesn't get community values is because a lot of these people, they're the Sunday school values, they tell them to go to church, but these are the same values that rationalize why slavery is perfectly okay. Because after all, a slave is somebody's property. And they could say, it says so in the Bible, some people are born to reign and some people are born to serve. And see, the Bible says that you have to have slavery, it's perfectly all right. So anyway, I mean, they have this kind of logic. Well, Huck just doesn't get it. And there are a number of instances in the novel where he'll Tom Sawyer, this makes perfect sense to Tom Sawyer, and Tom Sawyer is a different person in this novel than he is in The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. Tom Sawyer in this novel is going to grow up and he's going to be exactly like the people in the town. But Huck doesn't quite understand what's happening with the people in town. There's this big disjuncture. And the argument that I am trying to make is that by having this, Twain undercuts all the racist potential, all the racist pretensions of the community. So he uses this irony to do it. Now, and I want to get to Paul Moses and why, you know, it's, okay, why Paul Moses probably reads this novel the way he does. But anyway, let me give you a little bit more ammunition as to why I think Twain, you know, in my reading of this, that Twain is undercutting these racist pretensions. And I'm assuming it's kind of hard to talk to an audience that doesn't have copies of the book in front of you, so you're going to have to bear with me. But anyway, Pap comes along, all right? So the reason, does anybody know why Pap comes along? Because all of a sudden he's reformed and he wants to be a good father and he just loves Huckleberry and he's sorry he's been a drunk and sleeping in the tan yards and everything. Why does Pap come along? All right, that has to do with the fact that in that earlier novel, Tom and Jim, Tom and Huck discover this treasure in the pirate's cave. All right, so anyway, they got this money. It's enough to give him an endowment of a dollar a day apiece, he and Tom. So Huck's a rich man. And in that area, I don't know what a dollar a day would translate to. Now it might be like $50 a day or so. So Huck's got money. Obviously, talk of this travels down river. Pap hears about it. And all of a sudden, you know, he wants to be the father again, you know. But anyway, so he turns up. Huck sees his tracks. The first thing he does is he hightails it over to the guy who's a banker and judge. And he says, I want you to take this money. And he says, oh, and the judge says, I can't take your money. And Huck says, yeah, but I do. And finally the judge says, yeah, I get it. Okay, I see what you mean. So anyway, Huck knew Pap was in town. He immediately got rid of this money, so he didn't have it, so Pap couldn't take it. But anyway, the next thing that happens is Twain starts building up Pap's character, and this is really important in the novel to know what Pap is like, because for starters, Pap is, let me read to you what he is. Oh. You know, and you think about abuse and everything. There are so many different ways of looking at this. But anyway, when Huck comes up, the chapter 4 ends, when I lit the candle and I went up to my room that night, there sat Pat, his own self. So anyway, the chapter ends there. And he's there. He's in the room. And the next chapter opens with, and I had shut the door too. Then I turned around and there he was, and I used to be scared of him all the time. He tanned me so much. I reckon I was scared now too, but in a minute I see I was mistaken. That is, after the first jolt, as you might say, when my breath sort of hitched, he being so unexpected, but right away after I see I weren't scared of him worth nothing bothering about, here's what Pap's like. He was most 50 and he looked it. He had long hair and tangled and greasy and it hung down and you could see his eyes shining through like he was behind vines. It was all black, no gray, so was his long mixed up whiskers. There weren't no color in his face where his face showed, and folks, it was white. Not like another man's white, but a white to make a body sick. A white to make a body's flesh crawl. A tree toad white. A fish belly white. So, Katie, now what word are we hearing over and over again?
White.
So now, is this a mistake, do you suppose? Why is it Pap? So here you have this white guy who is just utterly despicable. All right, and as the novel goes on, you can see that Pap, it's not so funny after a while. Pap drinks a lot, he gets delirium tremens, he chases Huck around a tiny little cabin, tinier, like about as small as the rooms you characters are staying in right now with an axe. He's chasing him around. He says, you're a demon. But anyway, these scenes happen, and you can see that Pap is utterly despicable. There's not anything to recommend Pap. Now, I'll read the scene next that happens when Pap meets a mulatto guy in the street, all right? And it sounds racist to some ears. Pap's been mad that the government won't give him his money. He wants the money. So he's complaining about the government, and then, so I'll read you a paragraph of that, and then right after that, you'll see he runs into this black guy, or this mulatto. He's a professor. But anyway, first of all, yeah, it's important that I read that first paragraph before there, and now listen for the word that is just the absolute kicker in here. So he's whining about the government. He's called at the government. Why just look? He wanted his money. He's called at government. Why just look and see what it's like? Here, the laws are standing ready to take a man's own son away from him. A man's own son, which he's had all the trouble and all the anxiety and all the expense of raising. And you think, yeah. Yes, just as that man's got that son raised at last and ready to go to work and to begin to do something for him and to give him a rest, the law up and goes for him. And they call that government. That ain't another. The law backs the old judge Thatcher up there and helps him to keep me out of my, and the next word is property. Keep me out of my property. So, Pat not only wants to get money out of Hot, but he sees him as property. So, does this ring a bell in the Civil War South in Missouri at the time? All right. Right on the heels of this, we have here, Pat is also explaining what happened when this black guy walks down the road. He says, oh yeah, now he's also complaining about the government. Yeah, wonderful government. Why, looky here. There was this free nigger there from Ohio, a mulatto, he says. Most white as a white man. And he had the whitest shirt you ever saw, too, and the shiniest hat. And there ain't a man that in town that's got fine clothes as what he had. And he had a gold watch and a chain and a silver-headed cane, the awfulest old gray-headed nabob in the state. And what do you think? They said he was a professor at a college and could talk all kinds of languages and note everything. And that ain't the worst. They said he could vote. Well, when he was home, well, that let me out. Thinks I, what's the country coming to? It was election day and I was about to go to vote myself if I weren't too drunk to get there. But when they told me there was a state in this country where they'd let that nigger vote, I drawed out. I said, I would never vote again. And I think, oh, damn, what a loss to society. that was the very words I said, and they heard me, and the country may rot for all of me, and I'll never vote again as long as I live. And to see that cool way of that nigger, why, he wouldn't give me the road if I hadn't shoved him out of the way. And I says to people, why ain't that nigger put up at an auction and sold? And that's what I said. And why, they said he couldn't be sold until he'd been in the state 6 months, and he hadn't been there long yet. So you see the contrast, the ironic contrast that is at work in this novel. And you also see a little bit about the historical background of what's going on. Pat is mad that this black guy isn't going to get out of his way. But I mean, what does this black guy do? He has a clean shirt, he has a gold watch. What else does this black guy do? He's a professor. He reads. He can speak in a number of languages. What about Pap? What about Pap, John? Pap can read, right?
I don't think so.
He's completely illiterate. he has a white shirt. Mm. He has a gold watch, Pop. Mm. He has an ounce of sense. He didn't have anything. So anyway, Twain's very nicely set this contrast up. And he's also told us that Pap is white, but it's not a very attractive white. So, all right, so these things are going. Nevertheless, people like Paul Moses, they hear the word nigger, and I had a student in my class a couple years ago, and the first time I taught Huck, asking if lit could be bad for you. And this was a really bright student. He said to me, you know, I've read Huck. I understand it. I understand there's irony and everything else. And And he says, if you really want to know the truth, since I finally have a chance to speak out, he says, I hate this book so much that I had to go to the gym and hit a punching bag twice when I was reading this. I was so mad. He says, I'm a mulatto. He says, I don't ever like to read about getting shoved aside. So anyway, that's how he felt. And what Wayne Booth is arguing, that he is well within his rights feeling that way. And we can't just, you know, look at the audience here. We can't just say, well, you know, he doesn't get the irony, too bad. But anyway, there is irony in the work, in the book, but it's not without its trouble. So anyway, let me show you what happens the first time we meet Jim. Tom Sawyer and Huck have snuck out at night, and they're going to play a trick on Jim. And what happens, I won't read this to you, I'll just tell it to you. What happens is they come out at night and they play a trick, they steal his hat. And then Jim wakes up and he first thinks it's witches. And you know, these slaves would sit around and talk just like we are right now. He says, you know, witches stole my hat. And pretty soon more and more people said, yeah, there's witches in me. Tell us more about them. So just like any of us, when Jim tells a story again, you know, the story gets better and better. And pretty soon, it's not only witches, but the witches wrote his back, and they wrote them all over the county. And pretty soon, another group comes, and who would ever let the truth get in the way of a good story, right? So another group comes, and pretty soon, the witches are riding them all over the world, and he's got saddle boils, and he's charging people. I mean, they have to pay to hear the story. So you can look at that, and you can think, man, those people are really dumb that they believed in witches and they paid them to tell that story. Or you can look at it and think about Jim and how he was as a slave. What options did he have? And, you know, he's not so stupid. Telling a story, collecting money. I mean, how else is Jim going to get money? All right? But when we first meet Jim, you know, he said, duh, this is the very first word he says. You know, who did, he says, when he hears noise in the woods. So at first when you read, he does look really stupid. But if you stay with the novel, pretty soon, I mean, if Jim always looked great, there wouldn't be much drama in Huckleberry Finn. But the fact that at least in Huck's eyes, he really looks stupid and dumb at first, makes it all the more meaningful when things start to change later on in the novel. So anyway, I'll quit this in about 5 minutes, but I will never let you go if you don't listen to one of the most beautiful pages in all of American literature. That's chapter 33. Oh, I love it so much. Sometimes I can hardly read it. I just love it so much. But anyway, a whole bunch of stuff happens, which you have to read on your own. But finally, there's this drama where they're on the lake and or on the river, and Jim once again is stolen, and he's imprisoned, and Huck's thinking, if he's got to be a slave, he might as well go back and be by his family. And you can see there are passages in Huck Finn where Jim misses his family, and he weeps, and he cries, and he slapped his daughter around because she didn't obey him, and then he found out that she was deaf, and he just weeps over this. I mean, how could I have treated her? I didn't know she had you know, bad spell after scarlet fever, and this door, I told her to shut the door, and she wouldn't do it, and I told her again, and she just sat there grinning at me, and finally I got so mad, I whopped her, and so she cried for a while, and then he came back, and that door was still open, and he was mad, and then the wind caught it, and it slammed, and he said, she never moved. And he says, oh, Huck, he says, she couldn't hear. And he says, and I was treated so. Well, the irony of that is you consider how Pat treats Huck. And then you consider how Jim treats Huck and how remorseful he is about how he's treated his daughter. And your heart just aches. So his character develops. And so then Huck thinks, all right, so if he's got to be a slave, then he might as well go back to his family, and maybe I should tell Miss Watson, and you know, and then maybe I'll be cleansed of sin and I'll confess this. So anyway, it's kind of a long passage, but I'll read it to you. Anyway, so he says here, and the reason I'm going to read it to you is because right after this, the novel changes, and that's the big world, and we'll talk about it. Once I said to myself, it would be 1,000 times better for Jim to be a slave at home where his family was, as long as he's got to be a slave, and so I better write a letter to Tom Sawyer and tell him to tell Miss Watson where he was. But soon I give up the notion for two things. She'd be mad and disgusted at his rascality and ungratefulness for leaving her. And so she sails straight down the river again. And then he's worried about himself. And then he talks about Providence. And we're getting, I don't want to keep you too late before church. But anyway, about Sunday school and Sunday school values and Providence and everything else. And he says it made me shiver. And I about made up my mind to pray and see if I could quit being the kind of boy I was and be a better boy. Incidentally, by now, readers, something has happened in this novel where readers, I think, oh, Hawk, don't do this. We don't agree with Hawk. We don't want him to turn in Jim. So something has happened to make us identify with Jim, and now we are against Hawk. We think, oh, don't do this. But anyway, so he thinks he's going to try, but he writes this letter, and then at first he says, I felt good and all washed clean, and the first time I had ever, I mean, just like, and he's picking up this fundamentalist Bible thumper rhetoric. I felt good and all washed clean for the first time I'd ever felt so good in my life, and I knew I could pray now. But I didn't do it straight off, but laid the paper down and sat there thinking, oh, here it is, thinking how good it was. All that happened so, and how near I come to being lost and going to hell. And I went on thinking, and I got to thinking over our trip down the river, and I see Jim before me all the time, in the day and in the nighttime. Sometimes moonlight, sometimes storms, and we are floating along and talking and singing and laughing. But somehow I couldn't seem to strike no places to harden me against him, but only the other kind. I see him standing my watch on top of his and instead of calling me so I could go on sleeping. And I see how glad he was when I come out of the fog and when I come to him again in the swamp up there where the feud was in such like times and would always call me honey and pet me and do everything he could think of for me and how good he always was. At last I struck the time I saved him by telling the men we had smallpox aboard, and he was so grateful, and I said I was the best friend old Jim ever had in the world and the only one he's got now. And then I happened to look around and I see that paper. It was a close place. I took it up and I held it in my hand, and I was a-trembling because I got to decide forever betwixt two things, and I knowed it. And I studied it a minute and I sort of held my breath, and then I says to myself, all right, I'll go to hell. And I tore it up. It was awful thoughts and awful words, but they was said. And I let them stay said. And I never thought no more about reforming. And I shoved the whole thing out of my head, and I said I'd take up wickedness again, which was in my line being brung up to it. And the other weren't. And for a starter, I would go to work and steal Jim out of slavery again. And if I could think of anything worse, I would do that too, because so long as I was in for good, and I might as well go whole hog. So, all right, and so the audience, we're all with him. We are against Sunday school. We are against the community. We're even against Huckleberry Finn if he wants to turn in Jim. So something has happened in this novel to make us, you know, not identify with Huck as much as Jim. What happens next is Tom Sawyer comes on the scene, they're back to fun and games, Jim is a slave, and they play around, he's like, and he's dumb again, and people are enraged. All right, so how are you gonna get out of it? Well, for Paul Moses, you can't. It's just the irony isn't enough to carry the novel. All right, so, and for a lot of people, for some really compelling reasons, it's not. It's a flawed novel, and there's a lot of stuff on there. Okay, for me, I think that because of the irony, because of the play, I think that this has, it's not against, it's not as against racism, it's not as racist as it is anti-hypocrisy. I don't think it's anti-Christian, it's anti-hypocrisy. And if you read the very last passage in the novel, you'll see that the doctor comes in. And I think any nurse will tell you. I mean, I look at a nurse and think, oh boy, health, you know, right away. There's something kind of intimidating about nurses. And doctors are people you tell your most intimate secrets to and you trust. They're supposed to really be smart, right? They're supposed to be the smartest guys in the block and smartest women. And they're supposed to be leaders. You think they have ethical insights and values. I mean, we invest a lot in doctors. So anyway, at the end of the novel, the doctor comes along. He treats Tom Sawyer, who's got this bullet in his leg. Tom's delirious. He can't treat him. And he says, I can't. The guy's thrashing all over. And so Jim comes out of hiding at risk of his life because any escaped slave is probably, he might be property, so maybe they'd save him because he's valuable, but otherwise they'd execute him. But anyway, at great risk for his own freedom and his own life, he comes out. And the doctor, finally they get back Tom's saved, the doctor takes, he's afraid to leave Tom after this happens and go back and serve anybody in the community, and they all have needs, and he's got to get back to his patients. But he said, I couldn't leave the slave, because he might get away. Well, the guy, I mean, think about this. So finally, he says, imagine how hard this was for me. So finally, he gets back in the community, and he tells everybody, yeah, that nigger, he was really good, and he's worth $1,000. And kind treatment, but he's worth a kind treatment and $1,000. So you tell me, the doctor doesn't get it, and so the community, what do? They say, well, yeah, but they don't give. And Huck says, I wish they would have given him at least a little bit, something better than bread and water, and took a couple of his chains off, but they didn't. And I think it is just the way I read this, it's a scathing condemnation of that community. And, you know, and just to reinforce that with two other ideas is, at the end, Aunt Sally wants to civilize Huck, and, you know, what's the last line in the book, you know, he's going to light out for the territory, he's been there before, he doesn't want anything to do with civilization. So, for me, you know, I see it that way. But if you don't see the irony and you don't see the community, it's hard to see it that way. And some people don't. It depends, you know, so it's up to you. But anyway, the point I'm trying to make is, and we're getting a little bit late, we've got 10 minutes left, but the point I'm trying to make is that we're not wrong when we make ethical choices. These are issues that matter deeply to us. And I think great art and great literature give us those possibilities to talk about, you know, what we value, why we value things, and how. And so you can see it's probably good that Huck is banned every year. He's never not been banned ever since the novel's been written for various reasons. But some of that is good because it gets us to think. And what I wanted to lay on you before you left, I wanted to read you a few passages out of this. Lolita, Nobel Prize winner, Nabokov, excellent writer, really, really a great book. It would make your stomach turn if you read some. I don't want to do that now, but I will talk about this later this week. And I think we're all comfortable, pretty much a white audience, we're all pretty comfortable saying that, well, you know, this isn't racist. We understand the irony. We can read meanings in the text. But I'm hoping that you'll be sensitive to the fact that there are other people with other views. And a lot of it has to do with what you see in art or in literature and how you read it. And we'll talk more about that. I'll talk to you about Lolita. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the other issues throughout the week. And again, I'm so very grateful that you're here. We'll have a little bit of time for questions. I hope I see you back. But on the other hand, I want to strongly encourage you to go to some of these other sessions, too, because they are so good. Anyway, do you have any questions?
Yeah. I just would, I'm very curious about whether it's being taught at Augustana, if you have a core curriculum or how that's played out.
Oh yeah, I teach it every year at Augustana.
And in Chicago too.
Pardon?
And in at Chicago, University of Chicago.
I don't know for sure what they're teaching in the core curriculum at Chicago, but I would be extremely surprised if they weren't teaching along with, you know, Toni Morrison, who was at a residency there, and a whole variety of really fine authors. So, yeah, I'm sure that they're teaching that there.
Do you think that the Paul Moses perspective and experience changed the way it was taught?
It had to have changed the way it was taught, because otherwise Mr. Booth wouldn't have written the book that he did. It certainly changed the way I taught. They gave me some lily money at school to try and teach people on reflection, you know, how to reflect on what we do and how these, so that's how this came out, and that's why I taught it the way I did. Could it be bad for you? And that was the first time I taught it, that's when this black student said, I've never ever had the opportunity, people always explain irony or this or that, but I've never had the opportunity to say, I hate this now. And he was respected. In fact, he was, we had a poster that said, read, you know, the library had that. And honest to God, here this kid was with this book. This black kid, you had the Huckleberry Finn, it said read. So I think that he made his peace with it. But yeah, does anybody have any other questions?
I'm just struck by, I think maybe what's so hard for Paul is that it's the pain of it. You know, it's like we can kind of, if you're white, you can maybe on some level kind of approach it more intellectually, but this man, if he's black, he's had to live it every day. And that's the piece that we have to recognize, the emotional pain, and that if someone's angry about something like that, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Oh, we all have so much to learn, and I know, I'm glad you brought that up, Mike, because, you know, when I have, it's easier for me to teach Huck when I don't have black students in the class. When I have black students in the class and I read words like nigger, and, I mean, I just wince. I mean, it changes how I feel when I'm teaching it. Yeah.
No, I understand that.
I'm not familiar with Lolita. The connection there.
Oh, there's this guy, it's kind of a confessional novel, it's beautifully written, but he's fallen in love with this prepubescent little girl, and we hear all about nymphlets, so can you make great literature out of this, folks? Whoa, you know? We put that guy in jail today without a doubt. I mean, if we would put him in jail so fast today, and all of us would say yes. Oh, I'm not saying not Nabokov for writing about it, but I'm saying anybody who did that, they would be in jail so fast. None of us would want him in our neighborhood when he got out, if he served his time. That seems to be really black and white in our minds. You know, anybody, any older guy who preys on from a 9 to a 14-year-old.
But even at, I think it was in San Francisco, it wasn't the California College of Arts and Crafts, but one of the San Francisco art schools, there was this highly gifted 19-year-old writing all these things, and what he was writing was, you know, graphic stuff about going in and shooting up the classroom. And then they said he was the most talented writer, and then they threw him out of school. And they were going to arrest him because the content was just so much like Columbine-like.
Yeah.
Nobody, so there was no room for any irony. Whether he meant it or not, no one knew.
Yeah.
But, so
we live in an age.
The writer also.
That is such a good example, and you know, I'd forgotten about that, but I did read about that, and yeah. So what are you going to do with that if you're the principal and you know you're responsible for these children, and we're in an era where people are taking, little kids can take assault rifles to school. Yeah.
Well, it'd be so disturbing to get involved with this boy if it was a boy.
Yeah.
You know, or a girl, I'm assuming it's
a boy.
You know, and so to get involved in that internal life again, it's pain, and you have to get to know him, but to get to know all that, whatever's going on in there, and that's what's so hard. You know, I mean,
or he's just writing that. I have a kid who has written on this topic. Unfortunately, he's at Montessori school.
Which topic are you talking about?
Shooting in school. And why is he writing that? Is it because you know him, he's around the village. That's not who he is. He's very kind.
Uh-huh.
Her brother.
Uh-huh.
But that's what he's reading in the newspaper. That's what he's seeing
in
his culture, and that's how he's reflecting it back.
But then we don't arrest the creators of video games that depict the same kind of mayhem. But if it's a book,
or if
for
it's
some
in a classroom.
Reason,
but I really see those things as called invitations to get to know people. These kids are just crying out when they're doing that stuff. You know? But it's just so hard for us to even think about going there. You know, how can we generate that kind of, you know, hatred or that kind of disturbance?
Well, no, I guess I'm saying that the question about the boy in San Francisco, was he saying, I'm now going to write a book about this? Was it his cry, or was it his artfully constructed piece about that kind of story? That was what the question was.
Are the makers of Hollywood?
Was it his diary? It wasn't his diary. He was writing a novel.
But I don't think people can separate that stuff.
Well, are there?
It's hard to do. It's extremely hard to do, but it seems as though, I mean, it could be a reflection of a sick mind, or it could be a reflection of a child who's been exposing precisely what you described. But artists have always been on the cutting edge of issues that disturb us. You know, there's something about artistic people who they have the gifts. I think, you know, maybe it's my own prejudice, but I think that they're more sensitive than a lot of us. They have these insights, they want to put them on paper, or they want to paint them, or they turn them into music. And, you know, the rest of us don't always understand, but it seems as though history would certainly bear that out, that a lot of the art we have speaks to profoundly disturbing issues. And, you know, the rest of the public isn't always ready to see it. But it'd be interesting, I don't know if Holden has had somebody who can talk with you about art and those kinds of movements, but that would be just so great if they would sometimes, because I'm sure there'd be a lot to talk about how we value what we see. I can talk to you about lit, but I'm trying to imagine the other side if we didn't have ethical concerns in fiction. I mean, supposedly that's we're supposed to be objective. But is there such a thing as objectivity, and is it even good? I mean, we don't want to be biased or prejudiced, but I don't think there's a person in Holden Village who doesn't have in his heart, he wouldn't be here, concern about what human rights, about spiritual elements, about the environment. I think that's what brings us here. And those are all ethical issues. What if we didn't have any of those feelings? What would happen to people? Those are the scary people, aren't they? You know, who just don't think.
One of the things that I'm going to be talking about in my session is stages of faith. And, you know, how do you see a person who's in a different stage in their faith life? This is James Fowler's theory, you know, by interviewing people. Mm-hmm. Such as what you talked about here, and how do we form a bridge between, you know, that they do see it that way, but the reason being that that's where they are, you know, in their journey, in their faith journey, and I think you're opening that up, and that's wonderful.
Well, I don't have the answers, and
no,
I'm not the big expert, but I can give you the tools to start thinking about it, but. If it were just a simple answer, you know, ethics are never simple.
No. Well, and just going back to what you said earlier, you had that comment on the professor you had who wrote all these books that you used as you recommended highly.
Yeah.
There's the difference between having your morals that you base off of ethics and stuff and teaching them.
Yeah.
Because one of the great things that I've noticed just about the high school teachers I've had is that the ones who really get you to work are the ones who give you the tools but not tell you
right.
the answers. It's the difference between having the morals and feeding them down other people's throats.
Yeah.
Because you don't, at least I don't, want a teacher who's going to tell me all the answers.
Yeah.
You've got to figure it out for yourself. And so
right.
you don't want to hear their opinion straight off. You want to find it out for yourself. So.
And you know, it's so much better for the teacher because you can learn from the audience. They can always teach you something you didn't know before you walked in the door. But yeah, the idea is to give you the tools, all of us, to give it the tools to think. Anybody else? You've been a great group. Thank you so very much for coming. And I hope I see some of you around the village, and I hope that if you have any questions, you'd be sure to stop and talk with me. I may be resting my teeth tomorrow.